black people, I contend, had more intrinsic power at that time on a scale, I would say, than we have now.
Examining the history of civil rights in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, Labor Day, September 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as school gets underway, change comes to the state's largest rural district.
Possibly looking at things like having a centralized food service, as opposed to having each individual site kind of run their own.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The deadline for making candidacy changes for the November general election ballot is tomorrow, and talks are reportedly going between Democrat gubernatorial nominee Byron Mallott and independent candidate Bill Walker about a possible unity ticket. Just how that would be done remains to be seen. Running mates Craig Fleener and Hollis French would need to step out of the race. The Democratic Central Council meets tonight to vote on how to proceed. The Mallott campaign said the media can expect an announcement tomorrow. Students returned to classes recently across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Lower Kuskokwim School District Superintendent Jacob Jensen says change is on the horizon for the district with the largest number of rural students in the state. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
This year, the Lower Kuskokwim School District has new leadership at several schools. Superintendent Jacob Jensen says of the five schools in Bethel, three have had principal turnovers.
So the principal at Gladys Jung is a principal that's been here for quite a long time in LKSD. I believe he's on year 12, Chris Carmichael. The principal over at Immersion is a longtime LKSD employee by the name of Mike Smith, who had retired and decided it didn't suit him and came back. And then the new principal at BRHS has been a principal in Alaska for, I believe, 9 years. Her name's Elizabeth Balserek.
And the district is looking to reorganize behind the scenes, too. Right now, the district does a lot of what's called site-based management, which means schools and principals have a lot of autonomy to do things like set their own calendar, run their own lunch programs, and hire their own staff. But Jensen says LKSD is looking at more centralization.
Possibly looking at things like having a centralized food service, as opposed to having each individual site kind of run their own. Centralizing a lot of our technologies already happened. Looking at possibly maintenance, centralizing that. Purchasing. Right now, we try to kind of order the same types of vehicles and snow machines and four-wheelers, but we don't really have any policies about that. So kind of looking at all those type of things.
Jensen says LKSD is one of a handful of school districts in rural Alaska that still allows schools such autonomy. He says while local input and control are important for the district, officials may have to make serious budget changes in response to pressure from limited state and federal funds. He says the district can be more efficient with some centralized services. Jensen says also new this year, students will take fewer tests. That's a result of the state's waiver from No Child Left Behind.
As far as the waiver, it doesn't do a whole lot different other than the listeners should know that it was that by this year, all of our students had to be 100% proficient, which was an unrealistic goal. So the state got a waiver, and now we're working on what's called a growth model. So we're making sure that kids are growing each and every year.
In addition, the state high school graduation exam is no longer being given due to a proposal by Governor Sean Parnell that was approved by the state legislature this past year.
It made it difficult for some students that couldn't pass that high school graduation exam, and it caused some difficulties for students that wanted to get into the military and, go on to post-secondary options. And I think it was a good idea when they put it in place. It was a little bit difficult in implementation. So what's happened now is kids just have to meet the qualifying criteria of the school district.
Jensen says two other state tests have also been eliminated. The Terra Nova and the State of Alaska Standards-Based Assessment Test, also known as the SBA, which is being replaced with the Alaska Measures of Progress Test, or AMP, which students will take online. Jensen also notes that all children in the district can now eat breakfast and lunch for free. Studies show that kids who eat breakfast do better in school, and Jensen says he hopes the meals will help students excel. The Lower Kuskokwim School District stretches about 100,000 square miles and is about the same size as the state of Ohio. The district, made up by 28 schools with more than 4,000 students, has an operating budget of about $80 million. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, when civil rights activists from across the United States joined together to register black voters in the Deep South. It was a summer marred by violence and filled with hope for much of the country. But in Alaska, things were different. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned about race relations in Anchorage during the civil rights era.
Rosa Foster darts around her small kitchen making oatmeal. Formal china is on the table. Family photos line the walls and shelves. The hyperactive 81-year-old jumps from story to story as she puts away the tub of margarine and a box of sugar.
So anyway, I was a good teacher. I know I was. If you came from Miss Foster, let me tell you something. If you came from Miss Foster, you're going to know something.
We settle onto the couch in her crowded den, the TV constantly on in the background. She alternates between telling more stories and answering her phone as her oatmeal grows cold.
Do you want to eat some of your...
Well, I'll finish this. Anyway, so I told you wouldn't be able to do all this in one day. Didn't tell you that. I told you that.
Foster moved to Anchorage from Virginia in 1961 with her husband, who was in the military, and their two young children. She says she met her neighbors, who were all welcoming.
This lady and I, we were friendly. So months later, I thought, let me tell this lady that I'm a teacher. Just talking, because I'm getting closer now. And I said, you know, I'm a teacher. Oh, you do? You a teacher? Yes. She said, you want to go to work? And I said, oh, yeah. She said, because if you do, I'll watch the kids for you.
Foster recalls the intricate details of getting her first job as a third-grade teacher at Fairview Elementary. The way she tells it, she went to the school district administration and demanded exactly where she would teach and what level. She was one of the first black teachers in the city, but she says she didn't feel like any of the other teachers or the students treated her any differently, not like in Virginia. Foster says when they bought a house in Airport Heights in 1963, some of her friends were a bit concerned.
This friend I met told me, oh, there's no black folks in that neighborhood, child. Nobody living up there, you guys.
But her friend thought the Fosters might be okay, since they both had white-collar jobs. Foster says she became fast friends with her neighbors and taught them about her family's way of doing things.
Niecy, my daughter, would be in here, and I'd be pressing her hair, and this girl would be over here. What are you doing? I said, pressing her hair. That's the way you do it. So yeah, we do it like that. You know, not acculturation takes place.
Around the same time, Cal Williams moved from Louisiana to Anchorage. He had spent most of the summer of 1964 registering voters. That fall, he and two other students integrated Northeast Louisiana State College. As he was fighting to end segregation in his home state, two of his friends moved up to Alaska.
These friends of mine were saying, oh, we don't have all that up here. We've got white friends, and we're going to school out at the university, and they love us. We're playing basketball. So, indeed, that was a curiosity to me.
William says he decided to join them, and he did find a place where people of different colors were friends.
Black people, I contend, had more intrinsic power at that time on a scale, I would say, than we have now. At that time, there were a number of black people who had the ability to hire other blacks.
He says there were black-owned construction companies building for the government and black-owned clubs serving the community. But not everyone agrees that Anchorage was a relative utopia in terms of race relations. Richard Watts Jr. moved to Anchorage as a small boy in 1949.
Discrimination was hidden in Anchorage, Alaska in the 50s and 60s. Where if you were in the lower 48 and the southern part of the lower 48, it was out in front of you.
In 1951, the home of a black family in Rogers Park was torched. After that, Watts' parents helped start the Anchorage NAACP. Watts says the black community was only allowed to live in certain parts of town. No one would sell them a house in West Anchorage, so his family bought a home in the eastern part of Nunaka Valley. To shop, they drove to the Kars Brothers on Gamble in Fairview, because the store sold things like pig's feet and chitlins for cooking Southern soul food.
It was located in the heart of the black community and it was solely supported mostly by the black community, yet there was no blacks employed in the store.
So in 1963, when Watts was 16, the NAACP started a boycott. For 3 weeks, Watts joined others picketing in front of the store. And when the boycott ended, he was hired as a bagger.
Because you were put in that position representing the black community, you always had to put your best foot forward, and you worked 110% harder than anybody else there just to make sure that they would not have an excuse to dismiss you or demote you.
Watts says it was a comfortable place to work, and he was quickly promoted. Within a few years, he was a store manager and then the director of groceries. Now he's in charge of the beverage and tobacco divisions. But Rosa Foster says not all of the stores were as progressive as Carr's. She recalls trying to buy shoes at JCPenney's for her children and being ignored by the sales clerk.
She was helping another person, but she was through. But when that person came in, she went on and waited on her.
She hurries off to answer another call, her cold breakfast long forgotten. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, forecasters watch for signs of El Nino.
Right now we have slightly above normal sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Weather forecasters are watching for an El Nino this fall and winter. The equatorial Pacific Ocean warming has been observed in its early stages this summer. National Weather Service Alaska Region Climate Science and Services Manager Rick Toman is tracking conditions that signal El Nino.
Right now we have slightly above normal sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific, but really a primary indicator of what we're going to see in the future is there's a significantly warmer than normal water below the surface, and that will come up and help warm the surface. And we are just in the last month or so starting to see the atmosphere couple to that.
A watch for a weak to moderate El Nino is currently in effect. The naturally occurring atmospheric pattern develops every 2 to 7 years and normally lasts 9 to 12 months. The last one occurred in 2009 and 2010. El Ninos generally push warm, moist air toward North America, an influence Toman explains is hard to fathom given its far-off origin.
1,500 miles south of Hawaii to north of Australia. How can that possibly affect Alaska's weather? Well, over those very warm equatorial waters, big thunderstorms will grow, and it's those thunderstorms that reach very high into the atmosphere that moves northward away from the equator, and then that changes the strength and location of the jet stream coming off of Asia, and that's how we tie into Alaska weather.
Regional impacts of El Nino vary widely. Toman says historical records include above normal precipitation in southeast, south central, and western Alaska, with a statewide autumn trend toward warmer than normal temperatures. Three Kenai Peninsula residents have filed complaints with the Alaska Public Offices Commission against statewide public officials for failure to disclose gifts. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The three complaints were all filed August 25th with the Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC. They were filed against Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell, and Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Ed Fogles. Homer resident Elaine Chalup filed the complaint against Fogles. It states that in 2013, he failed to report attending the Kenai River Classic and accepting numerous gifts from the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, or KRSA. The Classic is a fundraising event for fisheries education, research, and management. Fogel says he did report the attendance and gifts, but not to APOC.
I did disclose it internally with our departmental ethics process to our ethics officer, which was filed with the Department of Law. So it was all up in the open. I did not realize I was supposed to also file that with APOC, and so that was my mistake.
According to the KRSA financial disclosure forms for that year, Fogel's was given a gift estimated at $6. That's the estimate for a pair of gloves. Other items KRSA gave out included a shirt, a baseball cap, a jacket, and a gear bag. In total, they're worth about $162. But KRSA notes that promotional items with KRSA's name on them do not count as gifts, so that reduces the gift amount to just the $6 pair of gloves. Fogel's disclosed gifts came to a much higher dollar value.
In my disclosure for 2013 was that the total value of the gifts were for $565, and the gift was for meals and the fishing down there to participate in the event.
Another Homer resident, Garland Blanchard, filed the complaint against Commissioner Campbell. According to the filing documents, Blanchard shares a P.O. box with Chalup. The complaint states that in 2011, Campbell failed to report attending the Classic or accepting numerous gifts. Campbell was unable to be reached for comment by deadline. Her office stated that she is out of the office for a few days. Kasiloff resident Benjamin Clare filed the complaint against Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell. It states that Treadwell failed to report his daughter attended the Classic in 2013, failed to report the gifts she accepted, and failed to report the waived entry fee of $5,000. Treadwell is also noted as having received. According to Treadwell's financial disclosure documents, he reported a gift in the $250 to $1,000 range. Treadwell was approached for comment. He declined to speak on tape, but said he would be requesting that the complaint be dismissed and said it is not valid and is groundless. Treadwell, Campbell, and Fogels have until September 11th to file their response. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Using seawater to heat large buildings in Alaska is no longer a pipe dream. Andy Baker, an engineer with Your Clean Energy LLC, helped design an ocean-sourced heat pump system for the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, which will pay back the community's investment in less than 9 years, just in fuel savings. Baker spoke to the Sitka Chamber of Commerce about the possibilities. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
There's a big difference between talking about an innovative heating system that's on the drawing board and talking about one that's now used in places like Seward, NOAA's Research Lab in Auk Bay, and the Whistler Village and Convention Center in Vancouver. Baker described how the thermal energy carried in the current along Alaska's coastline originated on the equator. Resurrection Bay, which supplies the Seward Sea Life Center, has a staggering amount of energy available. Baker tried to describe it in terms Alaskans might understand.
Here's the real aha picture. This was taken by the CEO of the Sea Life Center in 2009. This is in November. The seawater temperature is 50 degrees. The outdoor air temperature is 22. So what you see is you see the latent heat of that body of water. It's just a big bathtub, hot tub of water steaming off. This bay is 2 miles wide, 2 to 3 miles wide, 11 miles long. So we've calculated the volume of the bay, and we know that it raises 15 degrees in temperature over each summer season. We calculated how much heat that was, and if you tried to heat that bay using the Trans-Alaska pipeline, you would have to burn it for 50 days 600,000 barrels a day at 85% efficiency to heat all that water up. But we're getting it for free. So it's 20% of taps in just one bay.
The disparity between ocean and air temperatures in the fall in Seward is because of the warm current. The difference isn't quite as extreme in Sitka, but the result is the same, a basically limitless supply of seawater at a stable temperature that never freezes. Baker says the taxpayer-owned Sea Life Center turned off its two oil-fired boilers in 2012 and began to realize savings of $10,000 a month in fuel, or $120,000 a year. This will pay back the original investment in a little under 9 years. Air source heat pumps have been gaining ground in Sitka. Blatchley Middle School has heat pumps, the remodeled Harrigan Centennial Hall is slated to get them, and dozens of homeowners have installed residential versions. Only the Sitka Sound Science Center has been actively pursuing seawater heat pumps and has installed an upgraded seawater intake for its aquarium that can be adapted to heat pumps. Baker says there's a common misconception that heat pumps circulate corrosive seawater. Not true. The seawater raises the temperature of a coolant loop through a heat exchanger and then is returned right to the ocean. And for corrosion resistance, the heat exchanger, like the one in Seward, is made from titanium.
And so this is really the star of the system outside of the heat pumps. There's no moving parts. That's a $28,000 unit. It's about 7 feet tall. It's 126 plates in it. And in advance of that, we have an inlined filter that traps particles, so we don't have clogging in the plate exchanger. And the Science Center here is looking at a similar system, and we'll have to have similar hardware, but it'll be on a smaller scale. And this is one of the most important investments. If you do this part right and you size it right, you'll have plenty of heat coming into your system.
Baker also discussed expanding a seawater system beyond a single building into a neighborhood district. The concept is already in use in Scandinavia. It functions like any utility, electricity or drinking water, but in this case, it would be a coolant loop. Residents could connect heat pumps to it or not, and cities understand pipes.
For the city, it just means that they're not in the heat business. They're just pumping a loop of cold water around. That's something you already do with your water system.
Baker touched on some other advantages of seawater-sourced heat pumps. Unlike air source, they don't become inefficient as the air cools down. Just the opposite. The greater the difference between the air temperature and the water source, the better they perform. There's also no pollution, especially when the electricity is coming from hydropower. Baker said that liability, which can be mitigated in other forms of alternative energy like biomass, is off the table for seawater heat pumps. He cited other tangible benefits like more jobs for people to run and maintain neighborhood districts and lower costs for residents and businesses in the winter. But he said not all benefits would be tangible.
If you do a project like this, people will start to identify your town with that innovation. People respect that. They look for that leadership.
Baker says that the Seward project benefited from two grants from the Alaska Energy Authority's Emerging Technology Fund. He described the Alaska Renewable Energy Grant Fund as more problematic, since it assigns communities like Sitka and Juneau lower fuel costs than elsewhere. Baker felt that if the AEA accurately reflected the cost of oil in its grant formula, Sitka would have had seawater heat pumps last year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
18 Ketchikan residents became U.S. citizens last week. KRBD's Layla Carey attended and has this report.
Oh, beautiful for spacious.
The back rows of Ketchikan's old-fashioned federal courtroom were filled with family and friends, while in the front were all the soon-to-be new citizens, smiling wide, dressed up and holding small American flags.
All rise. For honor of the court, the United States District Court for the District of Alaska is now in session. The Honorable Leslie Longenbaugh presiding.
Federal Magistrate Leslie Longenbaugh officiated the ceremony. She told the group that it's inspiring to see people born in different nations raise their hands and swear an oath to become citizens of the United States. And she says that naturalized U.S. citizens have made tremendous contributions.
President Obama recently told some new citizens, "What makes us Americans is something more than just the circumstances of birth. what we look like, what God we worship, but rather it's a joyful spirit of citizenship. Another president, Theodore Roosevelt, famously said it 100 years ago. Americanism is a question of principle, of idealism, of character. It's not a matter of birthplace or creed or line of descent.
Gary Johnson is an officer with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. He presented the petitioners.
Examination of each candidate by a USCIS officer establishes that he or she has lived within the jurisdiction of this district and been a person of good moral character for the statutorily required period of time, usually 5 years.
Launenbaugh then administered the oath.
I hereby declare on oath. That I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign...
Tracy Clark is the port director with U.S. Customs and Border Protection in Ketchikan. He addressed the group after they officially became citizens and says it's a great day for them, but also for the United States.
But you have the power to shape this country. Okay? We all have that power in us, so I encourage you, now that you're citizens, to watch the news, see what's going on, see what the challenges are that we face as a country. The world is pretty messy and edgy right now, and we have a lot of important decisions, and now you have that right, that unalienable right to go and make shape this country as a voter.
Each new citizen was invited to speak. They gave their names and the country they came from. The Philippines, Saudi Arabia, China, Russian Republic of Georgia, and Nigeria. They all added that they're proud to be U.S. citizens.
I'm Marilyn Koseki, and I'm from the northern part of the Philippines. And I'm almost more than 4 years now here in America with my loving husband. And thank you, America, for giving us the privilege. And I am proud now to be a U.S. citizen.
After the ceremony, the new citizens and their family members flocked to pose for photos with Magistrate Launenbaugh, Gary Johnson, and the courtroom's large U.S. flag. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.